This episode is brought to you by Haptix. Do you want to help build the future of VR? Haptix is hiring. Haptix is a team of engineers that's researching, developing, and productizing haptic technology that makes virtual reality feel real. Ben Lang from Road to VR describes Haptix gloves as the closest he's come to touching the virtual world. If that sounds like something you want to be a part of, visit haptix.com/careers. That's haptix.com/careers. And be sure to reference the Research VR podcast on your application. I've actually gone down to the offices of Haptix in San Luis Obispo in California, and it's a wonderful place with a bunch of really interesting people that love tackling one of the hardest problems in VR, which is haptic feedback. So if you're interested in this technology and can see a future in it, which we clearly do because of how much we talk about it, look at the open positions that Haptix has and feel free to apply. I know a lot of you that are listening are developers, hackers, engineers, coders, designers, a whole bundle of talents that are needed in this new and interesting industry. So check out Haptix's careers page. I should mention that we want to also use this space for sponsors to give you listeners things that you actually would like to know about, whether it's products that we have no problem endorsing to you, the developers, or even career opportunities that are open from these companies for developers like you. So everything that you will hear before and after each episode of this podcast, I promise you, will be entirely relevant to your interests and might even be a great career opportunity for you. So check them out and on to the show.
Welcome to a new episode, a very unusual episode of Research VR. Yes, I'm not Azad, I'm Peter. And the reason I'm Peter and I'm not Azad who is doing the introduction is because Azad right now is in Berlin and I am in Prague. Yes, Azad is usually in the US and I am not in Prague. But the reason because I am in Prague is I've been visiting a company that once was already featured on this podcast, namely the VR Engineers. And right now across me, there is Marek Polczak, who is the co-founder of VR Genius, right? Hello.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Well, you're the first one to ask this question. I'm doing quite fine. I had actually a very wonderful day. So VR Genius were so friendly to, take 5 hours, I guess, and show basically every of their secrets inside the office. And maybe not every secret, I guess there's a secret room I didn't see. But I see a lot of technology. I've seen a lot of innovation. I see a lot of, people who are very motivated in that office. And I think I want this episode to focus on a small review, what the first episode 1.5 years ago named the 5K resolution headset by VR Engineers was about. It is number 45. If you want to re-listen to it, it's a little bit cringy because back then I wasn't that much experienced and, the podcast audio quality wasn't that perfect, but yeah, it's fun. It was on the 4th August of 2017. So roughly 1.5 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of things changed. So let's start with you. Your overall background was explained by you quite in detail in the previous episode, but maybe you could still do a short overview. What's your background? Where do you come from? And why are you doing what you're doing?
Okay. So my background is electrical engineering. I studied here in Prague at university. And basically the whole team was built there, to be honest. We did a lot of projects together. We built our own robot. And then during 10 years, we helped different and internationally successful companies to build their own software and hardware products. So that's how we learned how to do these kinds of projects, which are complex. Not easy to estimate, but then the reward is great.
So back then, we met you by sheer accident. Chris and me were on the CeBIT or Hanover?
CeBIT.
It was CeBIT. The CeBIT is dead, by the way, now, very sad. But back then...
That's something what changed since.
Yes, it's not the only thing, but that's definitely a major change. The biggest exhibition worldwide used to be, now it's dead. But what's not dead is your headset. And back then, you were kind of very secretive. You had a tiny little booth and you were kind of not very open. You didn't want people to take photos and you were very protective because I guess it was like the first major public announcement that you did over there. What did you show back then? what was on the table?
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. It was like the early version of the first prototype, which we were able to assemble. And of course, when you spend a lot of time and effort developing something, and then the day is there and you would like to showcase it, you are afraid that something will not work, something will go wrong, and it's still work in progress. So from that point on, we moved quite significantly. Earlier this year, a few months ago, we officially released a new headset, Axel, a few months after we even released a new significant update of the new lenses, which we finally finished the development. So mm-hmm. if I should compare back then and today, even though it's only, let's say, 1.5 years, it's incredible how fast we moved forward. Because back then, when I afterwards showcased the headset, we got a lot of negative feedback regarding the ghosting, for example. And that was because we used basically mobile phone panels, LCD panels, which were quite slow, a lot of latency and so on. So then we developed new versions, which to best OLED VR suitable panels we were able to get. And the interesting thing about this field and in general, I would say, is that when you have a product which has the highest priority and you remove it, it doesn't mean that you remove the highest priority. It means that something else is now the highest priority. So then it was a distortion. When we improved that, then it was the size of the headset. And after a few iterations, we managed to make the new Axel, which basically addresses all of those requirements from our clients.
I have here a big list of things that changed or been added or are a new feature. But let me ask you that question. What did not change? Is there anything similar to this headset that I saw 1.5 years ago and to the new version? Except, I mean, even the shape changed.
Yeah, like few chips are still the same. Let's
probably
say maybe
USB.
Two chips. But what did not change is actually cabling so far, because we still use one USB, one power cord and one display port. But that should change soon enough, I hope, with the virtual link.
Back then you were using two HDMI cables.
No, never. I've been a big promoter of using only one display port. Because first of all, I love the cable itself and the protocol, because it allows you to do much more than HDMI. And second, if you use two cables, you are multiplying the percentage of break.
Ah, okay, yeah.
And that's something what I really want to reduce as much as possible, because our products are about durability, reliability, and therefore I'm like big supporter of DisplayPort protocol.
Mm-hmm. So let's start it that way. I walked into the office and I saw that headset hanging down from a very interesting construction. So I will post some photos probably either on social media or on the Medium post, because I made a lot of photos of very interesting things. But to describe it audially, it was like it is some kind of half arm that is swinging around this rig that holds this cable of the headset, and the cable itself is 20 meters long. And in the end, there is a display port that goes inside the headset, but the cable is an optical cable, right?
Yes, exactly.
So you can do both. You can do normal
metallic port. Normal metallic display port, like mm-hmm. standard cabling, which we supply is 5 meters.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of our customers need longer installations with the arm to be able to freely walk around. But they still have this demand to see the highest possible quality, and that one you are not able to do with current wireless technologies.
Mm.
So what we have to do is basically use this small, let's say, crane or free moving arm, which is mounted to the ceiling, and use the optical cable, which is very convenient.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Do you know the name of the manufacturer of the cable?
Yes. This one we are buying directly from Fujitsu.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I tested about 5 of those. And I have to assure you that there are big differences in between, even though they say they are the same standard you have to test for yourself the timing and
it's
quite demanding.
It's interesting. And I've never seen in my life, I think, an optical connection between a headset and a computer. So this alone was quite interesting. But there is another cable going in the headset. That's USB, right?
Yes.
And you have also a free USB port on the headset. And on the front of the headset, you have the Leap Motion. So you have cameras from the Leap Motion and the ER blasters, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And you are the first headset to integrate the Leap Motion as an OEM.
Yes, to fully integrate it. So we are not using the Leap Motion, the one you can buy on Amazon or anywhere. This Leap Motion is just the PCB board with the SDK. And the great thing is it works in much wider field of view with less like wrong false positives and so on. So it's much more convenient than ever before.
I can totally just confirm it. It worked surprisingly well. I mean, we had Leap Motion multiple times on the podcast, and those are really good episodes, and I can only refer to them. And the company is quite amazing in pushing the boundaries of user experience and how would you do hand tracking interactions. And it felt really great to have a headset on. And if you're a developer yourself and you ever had the standard Leap Motion mount, when your hands go out of a certain degrees of view, maybe, I don't know, is it 40, is it 60, but it's limited, it closes tracking. But here I was able to have my hand, 170, 160 degrees probably out of my vision, and it would still track. But there is more to the headset. Now, when we look at the headset itself, the versions that I was trying, you put a Vive tracker on top, but the headset can support optical tracking by IRT, right?
Yes. Then OptiTrack, Vicon, MOSIS, and a lot others, like what we are doing, because we are not developing our own tracking. We think that there are many professional companies which are able to supply you custom solution exactly for your needs. So what we do is we are partnering with them and integrating the support.
So OptiTrack and IRT and all the other tracking systems are widely used in the industry for ergonomy evaluation or tracking stuff. So it is something that a lot of customers that you have probably have anyway in the labs. But what's also very important, you have support for SteamVR, which is not just applying a Vive tracker to the headset, but there is a special adapter that you put on the headset and connect somehow to the headset, probably via USB or...
What you can do, one thing is you just put the Vive tracker on the top of the headset and you apply our driver for SteamVR, and then you see our headset inside and as the tracker is used book. But then we also developed a clip-on to support Lighthouse 1.0 and 2.0, because one thing that still not that many people know, but it's there in the community, of course, that Lighthouse is owned and developed by Steam. So the thing is that we, same as HTC, are basically licensing the tracking, so we are allowed to use it.
Yeah. The relationship between HTC, Valve, and this whole shenanigans between them is very confusing, because sometimes, I can only speak from my experience, you ask the one party, like HTC, about the Knuckles, they say no, the Knuckles are developed by Valve. You ask Valve about headsets, they say no. So the reference usually each other to each other. It's a little shady, but you managed. And the crazy part is, I can confirm, it works out of the box. We actually tested the software that Chris and me are working on, at which was Pies, we will work. We just launched it, and it launched in the headset, and we didn't have to do anything. So it was like without any adjustments, it was just running on the headset. So SteamVR support seems to be quite stable and out of the box. But again, there is more to the headset. There's not just the Leap Motion, there's not only those trackings, but there is also the eye tracking, the screen, the lenses. And did I forgot anything? Not sure. But okay.
Voice commands.
Yes, you have also voice commands. We'll come to the voice commands because you seem to put way more emphasis on it than a lot of other manufacturers. But let's start with the panels. You have two panels. Each of them has 2.5K?
Yes, 2.5K quote HD resolution. They are OLEDs. They work on 70 hertz. and they allow us to operate them in VR mode, so special low persistent mode.
So you basically show a picture, make some black, show a picture, make some black, right?
Yes, most of the time at the picture, at the display, it's black and there is only a line of refreshing picture line.
One thing that surprised me about the overall view or like the visual fidelity was the brightness. It was like very sharp and very bright. And I guess I should here stop and describe another thing that you showed me that was a desk setup where you would have four different OLED panels. With different resolution?
Two different LCDs, two different OLEDs.
Ah, okay. And they had like different resolution, different refresh rates, and you also showed me different lenses. So you had a mock-up or like a version of your special lens that was developed for you, and basically lenses from different headsets that you could put over the screen and see the difference. And I have to say that I have to probably reconfigure it. I have to probably test it out again at some point scientifically, but what I saw and what I can describe is when I used your lens and I would put it on the screen, the distortion was less, there was a bigger field of view, and it was also brighter and sharper. But you're also not using the Fresco lenses that you have been criticizing 1.5 years ago, but it's some kind of special lens. How did you source it? Who built it? And how did you end up having it?
That's the big thing for me again, like the overall quality is not only about the display. For example, if you will just upgrade resolution, it doesn't mean that you fixed any problem. It can even downgrade the quality if you do it with wrong panel. So the lens is like one of the hearts at the end, with the display together with the algorithms of the head-mounted display of the VR headset. And I spent about a year trying to source the best lenses possible. I bought prototypes from everywhere, including UK, including Japan, Europe, China, from US military research. But at the end, they were all like Fresnel lenses, and they all have these artifacts.
Like God rays and stuff?
Yes, around the circles. Like when you see that one is changing into another, you always get distortion, you always get some artifacts, and you always lose certain amount of photons going into your eye, which ends up to look like it's darker. And I was not happy with that. And after some research and trying to finding the right partner, I found a consortium in Israel, and we agreed to establish a joint venture which will focus only on development of lenses for virtual reality headsets. And we, since that day, we spent like 1.5 years iterating and improving the lens together based on the feedback, based on the tests, on the measurements. So what you experience now is the outcome of this period of time.
And as far as I understood, it's also so far exclusive to you, right?
Yes, we own exclusive license, but it's not like we are somehow keeping it secret. We want to utilize it for the whole community. It's just about finding other manufacturers who will be willing to use the same or similar technologies, similar lenses that can be even modified for their use case. So they will not use like two high resolution panels, but for example, it's even possible for us to develop a lens that you will exchange in all mixed virtual reality headsets from Microsoft and get better visual clarity.
That's crazy. When the costs of the lens are not higher than better screens or a bigger headset, and probably the cost of the lens don't add that much to the overall price of a headset, even though, of course, your lenses might be more expensive, still may be a good option. Now, speaking of the lenses do automatic IPD, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have developed your own eye tracking technology.
Yes.
That so far has been used and is being used to change the position of the lenses to adjust to the eyes. But you also plan to use eye tracking in the future for more, right? So where do you see eye tracking fitting in the overall product of yours?
At the end, it should provide I would say, three main advantages. One is, of course, being able to do rendering in the area where you are focused with higher quality, higher resolution, at the end, ray traced. So we will be able to improve overall feeling without needing performance to render whole picture perfect everywhere. So that's like one point, right?
Mm. And so foveated rendering and saving a lot of performance. Okay.
Yes. And with new technologies, with new engine capabilities and RTX GPUs, new AMD GPUs, we are getting there. No doubts about that. That's one. The other is that we will be able then, again, to lower the bandwidth we need to deliver to the headset, because we can compress the rest, the surroundings. And that I really need to achieve to be capable to go wireless.
Yeah, or have a slimmer cable.
Yes. Like, now the optical one is slim enough, but to be able to move forward.
Of course, but probably having that high resolution, like 5K in the headset, and as far as I understand, or as far as I understood, you also want later to upgrade to 4K per eye, mm-hmm. which leave you with 8K. I guess the chip that is capable of handling 8K and that resolution is also pretty warm and big. So by reducing the overall bandwidth you need to deliver to the panels, you might also shrink the headset and reduce its overall warm, its overall heat production, right?
Yes, yes. But luckily, these chips are not overheating that much.
Okay.
Basically, your face is heating more than okay. those chips.
Okay.
And then, of course, with the eye tracking, what we can do is do different kind of measurements and analytics. But analytics are important when you are trying to train someone to get the data that he saw, what he supposed to do, and also to measure like the reaction, for example, in marketing studies. But there is much more that you can do with it. And that's what makes me really, really like tuned, because you can, for example, help people to learn read more effectively or detect different kind of diseases only based on the frequency of eye movement or changes of the pupil. And that's something what basically adds new options to the whole world of optometrists. So
I think we talked in many of the episodes about eye tracking being able to deliver stress measurement tools. So through pupil dilation, you can, you know, figure out engagement and also the stress. You can, through microsaccades and saccades, determine intentions. Of course, you mentioned correctly the medical case. I think someone told me recently, I don't even remember where, but probably need to dig up the study. Hopefully we'll find it for the podcast. Someone managed to measure diabetes with eye tracking. So by displaying in a headset different brightness levels and different mm-hmm. things, measuring how quick your eye reacts to them, apparently you can correlate it with your blood sugar response or whatever, which is also sounds super crazy, but very, very important. And I guess also being able to interact with the world through eye tracking technology, so through gaze or through intention recognition, might, you know, make this headset very unique, or not even the headset, but the overall experience. But you also have a microphone that, you know, most of the headsets have.
Yep.
But the demos that I tried, at least most of them had voice control, where I could, you know, say change tire or change the car color or format C. Format C, unfortunately, didn't work out. I tried. It was, you know, a nice test. Why do you put so much emphasis on this voice control? Because the only headset that so far has been using it is the Oculus Go. I have never heard or seen anyone being really fascinated by voice control of, you know, open browser or whatever. It's fine. But you seem to see some kind of value in it. Where do you see the value of voice control for your customers?
The thing with this is that we are trying, or in our vision, we believe that interaction in virtual reality very soon will be more efficient than with PC. Because it's not natural to sit in front of buttons which are shaped like a square and you should like click them and they have functions. It's not the way how we were born when when you are growing up, you are learning how to use your hands, how to interact with the real objects and with the people. And for all of this, what you actually use? You use your hands, right? You use your eyes to look around, and you use your voice to communicate. And that's the way how it will be soon enough. And of course, now it's early on, but you have a lot of stuff going on with recognition algorithms, with AI, with prediction. And we are trying to show the way that, look, this is how we will actually be able to efficiently work inside virtual reality. And that's what we need to focus on. And that's where we need to develop a completely new approach, how to design even user interfaces to make it possible. So that's why we are putting some effort to even promote it to the community and to share it around.
And luckily, you're not that crazy to develop your own voice recognition techniques, but you rely on Cortana, I assume, right?
Yes, yes. In this case, yes. With the eye tracking, eye tracking technology is complex. On the other side, I've spent my bachelor study and then master degrees and then even diploma researching eye tracking, and we were specializing in learning if we are able to determine the positive negative reaction based on the change of pupil. So it's not that far away of doing your own eye tracking algorithms and whole system. So that we managed quite well, I would say.
And where do you see the eye tracking technology you develop going further? Because so far it's 30 FPS that the eye tracker is running, because you use it mostly for automatic IPD. But you want to scale it up, right?
Yeah. Like the current version has cameras with 30 FPS. It's not even like publicly announced that the headset has these capabilities, but it actually has. And it's only for IPD and for, I would say, research, testing and proof of concept. And now we are manufacturing, again, improved version, which has cameras capable to run on two different frequencies. One is 120 hertz, so you will get 120 FPS, and the other is 200.
Which is crazy. 200 should be almost enough to do microsaccades, right?
Yes.
Which is quite fascinating. We will talk later about why you chose to develop a lot of your own technologies and why it makes sense in the landscape and the economy that we are right now in with big and small manufacturers. But let's first describe the headset itself. So it is kind of bulky, but not too heavy. It sits quite decent on the head, has this automatic IPD, but you can also change the focus. So people who have impaired vision can compensate through rotating a wheel, right? So yes. It is very flexible. You don't need glasses really to wear it.
Most people don't, but we designed the lenses the way that, again, people are able to fit in with glasses as well. Nice. And that's actually the big issue with
a lot of headsets.
A lot of headsets. And when you are inside the business environment, like 50% of people wear glasses and they need it to work. So you have to adapt.
So the overall focus of your device with its price tag over $5,000 and also the way how you communicate is clearly, and I mean, it's pretty obvious, B2B. Yeah. We talked about it 1.5 years ago, and back then, as far as I remember and as far as I learned from re-listening to this very cringy episode, please don't listen to it, your ideas back then were a little bit less focused, so you were still speaking about VR cinemas, about different cases where this technology back then was totally feasible, but from what I have seen, you scaled it more down to the engineering B2B area, right? Would you say this is correct, or is there any other verticals that you right now are actively persuading?
Like right now, the biggest traction for sure is like transportation industry, automotive, aerospace, and even like ships or trains designs.
Because, helicopters.
Yeah, helicopters. And then simulation, like pilot simulations, flying around with the helicopter or with the airplane and learning how to operate it. These are segments where professionals are really prepared to immediately use the headset. and scale up and benefit out of it. Then, of course, you have, for example, architects who can benefit out of it huge, big time, but they are not prepared. They are not that much geeky as we are,
yeah,
I would say.
They have a different economy.
And then you have, for example, location-based experiences where I still see a lot of potential, and I am in contact with few of the most well-known brands of location-based experiences. And I would like to modify the headset for their specific needs, because from what I understood, and I'm not like specialist in location-based, I had my own location-based, which had like over 35,000 people trying out, but that doesn't make me a specialist in that field. That most important is that the experience is great from like end customer point of view, at the end, independent of the technology. It's about the great storytelling, about the great experience. But to make it like scalable and basically pay back the investment, you have to do it that it's fluent, it's effective, so people don't lose time in between. And it has to be like a very high hygiene standard.
Hygiene.
Yeah.
That's of course an issue.
So that one, for example, is still interesting for me, and I'm still speaking with some companies about building this location-based experience custom headset.
It's quite amazing how much location-based entertainment managed to move forward since the last time we did an episode. I mean, we have been both on VR days, and there was a special track just for location-based entertainment for the investors. There are like a lot of competitions there and a lot of companies very much in China and in the Asian market, but also in Europe and US. But I guess for them, it's also important to have a high volume of devices, and probably for them, the price is a little bit more sensitive, right, than for an engineer or for an automotive company.
For them, the price will have to drop down, and we will have to produce in larger scale.
Of course.
The same actually applies for gaming. Like, in the future, I hope that we will get opportunity to build a gaming headset, and I'm even discussing with a few influencers and YouTubers, like guys who tested everything, how to build such headset. And I hope
a specific headset for a specific game.
Not for the specific game, but for the gaming, like professional gamers. Let's say that I really enjoy playing games, and I do. And for that, I am willing to buy a controller. I am willing to buy an expensive mouse, and I'm willing to buy a high resolution, cool display. And same, I think, will apply for the headset. And for that, I'm trying to find the right partner, someone who is established, someone who has a base of the customers that we will be able to basically produce it together so it fits.
So World of Tanks, Counter-Strike, Fortnite, some of those huge
like
fan bases.
Actually, World of Tanks will be great because we can embed it into the helmet, so you will have like complete feeling of sitting inside the tank.
Mm-hmm. Small point was, I think I didn't mention that the headset has some weird hooks on top that are designed to put a face mask for hygiene reasons, right?
That's like a fast lock-in, lock-out system, which allows you to exchange the head strap in a few seconds. And the idea is that it can be used for location-based, where you give head straps in advance to people standing in the line. So when they come along, then you just click the headset on them and they are ready to go. That's like one scenario. And the other is when you are doing simulations and training, very often they use certain type of helmet. It helps with the immersion, and also they are like people are more comfortable wearing exactly the same helmet as they wear when they are piloting the helicopter. And for that, again, you have different sizes of heads, and you don't want to buy electronic for each and everyone.
No, of course not. One of the demos I tried at your office here in Prague was a special helmet attached to your headset where I was flying a helicopter. So it is a helicopter training application, helicopter flying training application. And it was very, I mean, I'm not a pilot, but it was amazing to put on this bulky, huge, you know, isolating helmet. I was almost feeling like, you know, it increases the immersion. And I was totally thinking about, you know, I would like to, as I mentioned multiple times during this podcast, I am a big fan of World of Tanks sometimes, usually. And I even tried on the VR days, World of Tanks VR arcade game. And I would totally buy some kind of crazy rig at home and, you know, just simulate the Panzer that I'm driving around. But you had also a racing experience. You have some other training experiences, I guess. So I tried the racing. I tried the pilot training one, which both felt very immersive. And because of the field of view, the sharpness of the image, and the overall feeling of the headset, it was definitely feeling like a training experience. So it was not feeling gimmicky at all, not as a single point. Let's say if we would try to build for fun the same experience with an Oculus, or even Oculus Go, because you don't even need that visual fidelity. It would feel more gimmicky because the heaviness of that helmet plus this headset that provides such a good visual fidelity just made it appeal together with the pedals and everything and the joysticks. It felt probably very similar to a helicopter, very real. And from what I know about training is very sensitive to muscle memory, and you need people to perform very concrete and right actions in the right way. Otherwise, as much as you train them, they cannot apply it one-to-one in this millisecond reaction time, because it needs to be in your spine, it needs to be your muscle memory that you're using. But one thing that, well, I didn't notice while trying the helicopter example application or the training application, but you explained me later, is tracking. So I did not have any positional tracking, as far as I remember, during the helicopter flight, but you're working, so far it's obviously a prototype, also on inside out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which would allow those seated experience to be way more immersive.
Yeah, without need of installing anything. That's true. That's true.
And do you have a roadmap for the inside out tracking, or is it something that, as most of your customers so far rely more on the more expensive OptiTrack systems or IRT or any other optical systems, or even SteamVR tracking system? Is it something that you see as a necessity for tomorrow, or you're just looking out into the future potential of this?
Like right now, it depends on the use case. Of course, if you are in a fully equipped VR lab, you don't need it. But in my vision for the future, it's a necessity, because even though you will use, let's say, Lighthouse 2.0 at home in the future, the thing is that if you still have the inside-out tracking, you can combine these data. And when you get out of one tracking, the other can still work on. And that's useful. You can also apply like data fusion, which will allow you to make both trackings together more precise. And that's where I see added value, even though if you have multiple tracking options.
Another thing that I actually forgot, I think we slowly should go over to the economical circumstances of building headsets, but one thing that I forgot is EEG, brain-computer interfaces. Surprise, surprise. As recently also reported by Road to VR and Upload, you partner up with Neurobose emotion analysis device, which is basically a dry EEG electrode that you can attach to your headset, and you can measure the probably the whole back of your head, so the whole visual area, maybe a little bit more. Where do you see the potential of BCI in the ecosystem of your headset?
For this one, I really see the use case again in the training of the operators of complex machines, because in those cases, you really need to make sure that the person operating it is focused, basically did not fall asleep or does not look into like nowhere, but is focused, is present, and you can see if he's basically on the right learning curve to master the machine.
We will soon have an episode on using EEG and VR to do meditation, relaxation, and other things where the company is using EEG for measuring cognitive load. And from what I understand about EEG, you can measure cognitive load by measuring different frequencies. So you don't even need ARPs or any location of the head, but you just need few electrodes, which obviously could correlate with how well you train. You can use eye tracking, but you can also use EEG to determine the cognitive load, which shows how much you learn. And during VR days, I will also link that talk. There was a talk about using EEG to determine cognitive load and showing that while you do train in 3D versus 2D, in 3D your cognitive load decreases, which correlates with you learn faster and it's easier for you to learn. So a lower cognitive load during training would, from the research, it just suggests show a better training output. So when you have a lower cognitive load, but you still perform well, you obviously learn quicker. How far are you with integration, and how far are you with integration, and who do you think will be the first customers to apply it outside of research, or maybe some neuromarketing labs?
Yeah, like the first use case is actually with the marketing agency to measure the impact of their product placement, basically, because that's the use case that's being used and has immediate outcome out of that.
I see. So a lot of crazy technology. I need to double check, but I think Azad's definition of headset 2.0, the headset that we all been waiting for, is almost fulfilled by your headset. I think the only thing missing is probably some kind of light field or depth display, which of course is very hard to do, and no one did it. Not even Magic Leap, as we discussed in our Magic Leap episode. It's not true,
light field.
Light field display. No,
it's not.
It's not. It comes closer to it than maybe some other headsets, but it's still not. So probably if you add to the hardware and software stack that you already have, which is just basically everything that anyone could come up with, can't right now imagine anything except maybe haptics, but haptics is outside of your headset, and maybe some, maybe the haptics device or the Tesla suit. If you add that, you can basically measure everything about the human. There is nothing else probably that comes to my mind. As there is nothing else that I would expect from a headset to deliver. You basically have the whole subset of stuff. How do you manage to build this headset, and how do you manage to, drive the business and an economy in Europe? So you're based in Europe, and we had earlier on, like one of our first episodes was on the glass ceiling in Europe. Europe has less investment compared to US. Europe has less innovation-driven disruption madness that, sometimes we perceive over, in San Francisco, but also we have less people than, let's say, Asia. So overall, it seems that it's way harder to build something in Europe that is hardware and software, and it's also way harder in general to build special hardware because volumes of your headsets is just way lower than any HMD manufacturer, which is not bad or good. It's just, the B2B customers are not relying on buying 3 million devices. Of course, we have headlines like Walmart buying 17,000 Oculus Go's, which is a huge, huge success for VR. But 17,000 Oculus Go headsets compared to the overall Oculus Go headsets is still a tiny drop in the ocean. And how did you manage to build hardware and software and source partners that still do those rather smaller batches that I would assume you have?
Yeah, like I will start with addressing the Europe axis, because how I perceive it is that Europe is a crossroad. Like we are in between, because we are not the Silicon Valley where the most of the investment happen. That's for sure. And we are not China, which is, I would say, a manufacturing superpower, really. Like they are able to manufacture biggest amounts for sure, biggest batches, but also very precise. So we are somehow in the middle, and that's not like ideal situation, because you cannot go to or focus on one thing or the other. You have to somehow balance everything. But actually what I think Europe is really good in is B2B. And you can see that very very easily in Germany, like where was developed SAP in Germany, like Bosch Germany, Siemens, Germany, Festo, Germany, all these big brands, KUKA, Germany, owned by Chinese, but okay. So you have this, I would say, stable background of internationally successful B2B facing companies. And that's quite a big difference. I would say that in US, especially in Silicon Valley, they are retail focused, because US market is huge and you are able to address it as whole. In Europe, we have a great experience with B2B and even with rolling it around the world. So I would say that our investors and our background is focused on rather long term than short-term retail, but on really like long-term sustainable growth over the years, which is good.
And of course, the B2B sector is slower with adoption, but once it's adopted to a technology, once one company that comes to you and gets a few headsets is really committed, probably they will continue getting the headsets because suddenly they figured out they really need them. So the overall start is slower, but the prices that the B2B sector is willing to pay for premium support, for better hardware fitting to their needs, is of course higher, and the long-term demand is higher. That's true. But still, you need to build those headsets. You need to source all those technologies. And probably there are some reasons why you have your own eye tracking technology and you developed a lot by yourselves, right? Because it's just not possible to source it for a non-consumer-oriented headset that easy.
Yeah, even for like consumer-oriented, it's quite hard, because in the general, mobile phone industry is the industry with huge amounts of consumption of everything, displays, chips, everything, batteries as well. VR headset market is like tiny in comparison. So it's challenging, but luckily we were able to secure some really strong partnerships, such as with NVIDIA. So we are cooperating with them closely to make sure that our headset works properly with their drivers, such as with BizLink, one of the most known cable developers and manufacturers, with different chip developers and manufacturers, with Valve because of the Lighthouse, and quite a lot of others, including like software partners like Autodesk or Dassault.
And I think you have also VRED integration, right?
Yeah, VRED integration we already did, and now we are working on other integrations as well, for example with ESI, again German company incidentally. So you have to really make those partnership happen and get the leverage from your clients or potential clients, so you get access to those technologies, because otherwise you're dead, literally. Like you can pay huge sums of money to get access to something, or you can get endorsement from clients, and that's what we do.
That's very smart. But still, you're only 30 people, right?
Currently, we are around 30 people.
And yeah. I guess you have had a smaller team before, so probably never shrinked, but you're rather growing, which means you managed to pull that off with a rather small team. You get still a lot of media attention, and people seem to overall really see the benefit in your technology. I mean, I tried it today, and I mean, the reason why I'm saying that the headset itself is quite remarkable is not because I know I've been invited and I tried it. It is because it's definitely something that I would like to have home. Now, the price is way too high and I don't need it home. But I would like to have this headset at some point in every consumer's hand. No, not as a is right now. Of course, it needs to be, in a sense, slightly smaller, cheaper, whatever, for the consumer market, but still, this is the future that we want to have at every desk or at every even mobile device. You know, maybe in 15 years, we can have the same level of technology you have right now in your headset and a mobile device. And funny enough, back then, 1.5 years ago, we compared you to the Steve Jobs of VR. And we also titled the episode with, you know, Marek looking for the transformative VR that would finally fulfill the promise laid out when virtual reality was introduced as a concept. And I think you're still following that mission. I think it's still not there, even though you made a huge leap and, I mean, you get more and more partners and it's being distributed, of course. But where do you see the roadmap for the next 5 years? Or maybe 1 year, or maybe 6 months? Where do you see those milestones that VR engineers needs to achieve in order to, in order for you to come home, sit down and say, yes, finally.
I managed.
Yes.
I know what you mean. Like, for me, the ultimate goal is to achieve that you, when you put on our headset, you will not be able to tell if this is real or not. That's my ultimate goal. And I will keep pushing it until we reach it. And yes, it's challenging, of course. But as Kennedy said, we don't do it because it's easy. We do it because it's hard. And I'm completely on the same page. I love that. I love that I see the progress. And yes, we are a small team, but that doesn't mean that we are ineffective. We are pushing the boundaries, literally. And I believe that today, thanks to new technologies, thanks to new algorithms, thanks to new software which supports our work, we achieved a stage where this kind of team, 30 people of fully committed professionals, I would say geniuses, is capable to be faster, more efficient than a big company with a much bigger budget to spend. Because we have the momentum, we don't have the overhead, we have a focus, we all understand the vision inside the company, and therefore we are able to move much faster.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say you are moving so fast, and let's, for the sheer fact, assume you are the fast-moving VR headset manufacturer, which I think in most of the areas of technology is probably correct, but let's just make the statement for the sheer of the argument. When do you see a realistic time frame for volumetric displays?
Volumetric displays? 3 to 6 years.
3 to 6 years. So even with your pace, even with your radical approach to, you know, we will slam every technology that makes sense for our customers, there is no way then, you know, sooner than 3 to 6 years, it will be finally displays that display true depth, right?
With displays, important thing to understand is that they are very expensive to develop and mass produce. We had high resolution displays, I don't know, 10 years ago, but they cost so much that only Army was able to afford it. And we were not able to get prototypes, even like big corporations were not able to get those. So it depends on the demand, and when you we consider VR and AR market still quite small, which means that it's not worth to spend that much money in development. So you have to utilize products of other markets regarding the displays. But it's coming there, but because of that element of that low demand, let's say, it will take longer than we are able to move. We are able to do it faster as companies, as people, as scientists. But we don't, because basically economy is the one keeping us slow.
Well, I mean, you have a good point. The fact that you can build the headset right now, and the fact that Palmalaki and was able to build the Oculus Rift back then, was economy of scale for parts for phones. So yes. you had a lot of, maybe you still have a lot of those wars of companies building phones over big supply of OLED. Now you see those headlines, Apple bought all OLED screens for the next years, and then Samsung bought the rest of it, and other manufacturers have a hard time. Now you obviously don't have a problem where you need, so far at least, millions of OLED screens, but you can just benefit from this high yields that those factories have. The question is, when we compare, and it's a strange comparison, but when we compare VR engineers to Magic Leap, right? Magic Leap, $2.4 billion funding, right? Magic Leap had of course, the backing of every major big investor, which, you know, has the ability to endorse and open all doors. And when we look at the final products, right, at your headset versus a Magic Leap headset, and I'm not speaking so far, but VR versus IR, it's more about what did you manage with the amount of people and money to achieve during that time. I see that your headset, well, not being consumer ready, doesn't have to be consumer ready, it's for B2B, but still pushes the boundaries on anything on the market. Maybe not all, but most of the features of your headset really push the boundary way further. And then you look at a company that had like unlimited money, unlimited resources, and what they managed to deliver is still kind of, yes, it's a good device. We discussed it in the episode. It's a lot of fun to develop for it, but the screen and everything else about this headset is not that much better than the competitors. Yes, they have tracking, but tracking is also done by other companies. Yes, they have, you know, waveguards, but waveguards are used by other companies. Yes, they have a very polished experiences, but well, that's what you get with money. Do you think that for VR, so far the parts that you can source and the economy and the use cases just allow for even a tiny team with the right mindset to, you know, do this big, strong leap forward, while the Magic Leap company just is facing physical limitations of physics, limitations of, you know, where is the factory where I can source my volumetric screen? If it's not there, they cannot build it. Even with 2.4 billion, they cannot build their own factory to produce their own screens. They still, in a sense, rely on other companies using those screens too. So there is no way that any company during the next time that I can come up with could, you know, start doing their own display technology or start doing everything on their own, right? You still always need to source things, even though you are an example of, you know, we develop everything on our own. Still, for example, with hand tracking, you did, from my perspective, exactly the right thing. You went to Leap Motion and you licensed, with kind of agreement, I guess, you know, them as OEM that delivers it to you. And I would expect Magic Leap, for example, or Meta, that unfortunately so far is not doing very well. I think that if they have done the same what you did, they would be way more successful. But they always stuck, you know, we need to develop everything on our own. Whether for you, it's we need to develop some things on our own because we just can source them. But as much as we can get, we just put off the shelf parts, right? And why am I asking that? Your headset is, you know, once again, pushing the boundaries of VR. Do you think that AR, so augmented reality, will be anywhere close to what we have been hoping for, we have been promised by those companies in the next 3 to 6 years? Or you're saying that, you know, without the volumetric screens and without everything else, there is no way there will be something as impressive from the augmented reality perspective and as useful and as you know, ready to be, you know, worn every day and used as is with VR right now? Or do you think that, you know, Apple will release the next year some crazy device and, you know, probably most consumers will switch more to augmented reality?
Well, like, I don't consider myself the expert in AR, obviously, mm-hmm. because I'm too deep in VR and, let's say, in mixed reality. But everything, literally everything, is about the right timing. If you try to do something too early, you can end up spending all of the money and not reaching. And if you try 2 years later on, you will succeed with, let's say, tens of thousands of the funding you should need a year before, and so on. So it's about having like really insider information which technologies are mature enough and can be implemented and used effectively. As you said, you have to choose wisely which technologies you will consider your technological mix, which you outsource, which you develop inside, and this has to be effective. If it's not, it will break your neck very easily and very fast. You will run out of money, you will get to the physical limitations, or you will find out, okay, these guys were too early and they are not able to supply what we agreed on. And there is always the risk, and that's what makes it so challenging.
When we look into the future once again for a second and see the development of VR Engineer's headset, but also the overall VR landscape, how do you perceive the overall VR community, the VR landscape, you know, in the last years that there was such a big hype around VR? And where do you see VR overall going? It's clear that you chose a very promising niche that, as multiple of our guests already said, the B2B market so far, even though it's not sexy, even though it's having definitely, not the appeal of I will make the next awesome game and I will, change entertainment forever, has the ability to push hardware further and, push also the use cases and create a mass adoption, at least in the B2B sector. But how do you see, you mentioned location-based entertainment, you looked at a lot of other VR headsets. Where is VR going?
The VR, same as AR in this case, from my point of view, are going to get closer to each other. I mean, the AR headsets in the future, I expect to have virtual reality functions, and the other way around. So the VR headsets will have front-facing cameras and will be able to switch to, let's say, AR mode. So at the end, everything will be MR or XR, whatever we call it. And that's like one thing that these two worlds will get closer to each other. And at the end, a few years later, you wouldn't be able to tell that this company started as VR and this as AR. So that's like, let's say, hardware-wise. The software-wise, I think that the big challenge is user interface, as I mentioned before, that all the applications has to become convenient to use inside VR more than with mouse and keyboard. And that is challenging because we are used to it and it's effective. We tuned it and optimized it over the years. We got used to it. Maybe we have to die out to next generation learn directly in VR and they will make it effective and suitable. I don't know. I hope not. I hope I will learn. but we will
see. I'm sure you're already there. I mean, your headset is basically as close as it can get to spatial computing because, it's eye tracking, voice, fingers. I mean, this is basically interacting with the VR world. But I mean, still, you see a lot of investors backing out of VR. You see a lot of companies, struggling. Even your close competitors, even if you would say their competitors like StarVR has a hard time, surviving. Pimax could be potentially your competitor, but they are more focused on the entertainment business and obviously not so much embedded in the B2B world. So it seems that you don't have many competitors, but it's also for a lot of other VR companies so that either the market is not yet there, the spirit of the people dropped a little bit, the investment money stopped, I don't know, but there seems to be like a term going around the VR winter again and everyone hopes it will go up again. Or is it something that you don't perceive at all and you just right in the momentum and you think, everything is going exactly organically right, it grows as it should, there are growing numbers of people buying headsets, there are growing numbers of use cases, and this is how it should be. So is it too slow for you, or is it exactly the right for you?
It's exactly as you said, you feel the winter of VR, that's where we are now, because the interest from investors is declining, going down. On the other side, the market is growing, and it's obvious. It's literally on our sales, on the interest, it's obvious. But the big hype connected with selling Oculus to Facebook and big marketing advertisements all over all the newspapers and web portals is basically over. And now we are steady growing segment, which needs to keep on doing what we do, which is improving. And we will be good. But the thing that we need to avoid is to make bubbles again. And that bubble can be caused by getting too much of investment, over-promising, under-delivering, and then ending up without the money and even without the product. And that's what we are trying to avoid, that we keep our costs low, our efficiency very high, and actually we are very close to reach break even. And when really? We do that, that means that it doesn't matter. If we get then another founding or not, because we will be a legitimate company operating in VR space, in VR hardware software space for a long run. And that's where I'm trying to drive this company.
That's something that you rarely hear from VR companies, that they are close to, being even and having a sustainable business, because particularly in the gaming industry, a lot is depending on whether there is hype about your game or not. And even outside of VR, a studio can have, you know, a successful game, and then it closes the next year because the next game doesn't succeed. So there, I think the overall economical circumstances are more inclining to, you know, overpromising. But there seems not to be a lot of VR companies doing as well as you, right? Or don't you perceive it that way?
I don't know about them. I don't know about them, yeah.
So is there any other company from the VR space that comes to your mind that you would say is, you know, doing as well as you? And I'm not speaking of Oculus or the big ones, but rather small companies. Are there any other small companies that, you know, seem to, you know, do quite a good job building hardware, building some special needs? I mean, we interviewed Starflight CEO on the episode. I think the episode should be out there, where they build this custom headset for premium in-flight entertainment, which is also a very interesting segment. It seems that instead of having this multi-purpose headset, as the Oculus promised to be and technically is, we are right now, at least, as it used to be with computers, moving towards, you know, special computer for this, special computer for that, special computer for this application, which is totally fine. But that means that there are not so many huge, successful companies in the realm of building something universal, right? So there is no iPhone of VR.
Not yet. Like, most likely we are close, the closest one to reach break even. That's most likely true.
Very interesting. I mean, I wish you would have a secret you could share. That is, like, you know, do those five simple tricks and your company will succeed.
Sorry, I probably have nothing hard like work. That. Just a lot of hard work. Yeah.
Yeah, would be amazing if we could have some really juicy, you know, with this five tips you can make every VR company succeed. But yeah, probably it's too much to ask. Now, maybe before we end the episode, what would you like to share with the world? What would you tell, particularly about the journey that you had during the last years building this company, that you learned about the VR industry? And, you know, what do you need? Where do you see people, you know, having a business case or something that will fit to you? Or, you know, when people want to contact you, what are you searching for?
Like, one thing I would like to say is that I'm grateful that VR community as community exists. I can feel, and I know a lot of people, great people around the world, who are trying to make it better, to make it more immersive, to make experiences better. And that's what makes me incredibly happy and really made my life actually better because. Mm-hmm.
More exciting.
I met a lot of people who became my friends. I met a lot of people who are well educated about this stuff. I can learn from them and we can share. And I think that we need to keep on being supportive to each other inside this community, because at the end, if one of us fail, it influences the whole market. And we would like to make sure that the thing we love stays and will be prosperous, and that will be my main message, because that's what I really hope for all of us, even our competitors, because I would be happy to cooperate with them to make this pie big enough for everyone, rather than really like compete against each other.
Yeah, the industry and the market need to grow in order for more companies to succeed and to be able to sustain themselves. No matter how much it's an instinct for competing with each other, the elbow mentality obviously doesn't fit to this community. I can totally agree with that. And I can only support what you just said. I also met a lot of great friends and a lot of amazing people and so much visionary thinking, but also, luckily enough, people like you are actually, you know, maybe, you know, I'm usually also very visionary and, you know, I always are in the clouds, but the world needs more people like you are actually building the stuff and deploying it and doing, you know, exactly what needs to be done. You know, build something out of those dreams that is feasible, that is not as far ahead as we all wish, but is pushing it forward. So what kind of partners are you searching for? What kind of use cases do you see? what kind of partners do you, you know, what kind of partners are you searching for? What kind of use cases would make sense? And how can people reach you for those requests?
Okay, so like right now, I see a huge potential really in these simulations. So guys who do different kind of professional engines, I would say, simulations like DCS, X-Plane, Flight Simulator, others, to directly contact us through the forum. I'm reading those emails, so it will go through me immediately, because that's where I really see a huge benefit for all of us, even to make me fly safer to US and back, because all the pilots will be able to train much more and much more precise inside the technology that we built, and that's actually great. So that will be for sure one. The other is that we are still open to new use cases and new partnerships, same as we did with EEG, same as we did with Unigine engine and so forth. So the thing is that we have to make the whole VR convenient for users. And therefore we need close cooperation, we need integrations, and we are here willing to do so. And then bring it to the customer to use it out of the box, the same way as you deployed your software today using our headset and changing nothing. So it's convenient, it's easy, it works, and then you are able to benefit.
Mm-hmm. And what's with scientists? After all, we are Research VR. Is there any interest from your side at the current stage of your company to have more scientists use your headsets to do research? You know, buy them in form of some kind of hardware grants, or, you know, basically get them for a lab so the lab can do it. Is there something that you see at the current stage of your company a benefit? Because, of course, if you would be 1,000 people, I would say, please just donate a few headsets to scientists. Now, I cannot say it to a team of 30 people that is, you know, doing already so much for the VR industry. But still, is there any value that you see currently from science which you would, you know, be happy about, or is it something that you want to do a little bit later on?
Like two use cases. One is that thanks to our own eye tracking, I think that our headset can be used for different kinds of experiments, that you can get actual like images of the eye to your computer for your own processing and your own analysis. Mm-hmm. And for example, trying out to determine the diabetes. Which is great, and I think it's a great use case. So for that, I think that the headset should be actually in each and every university lab around the world, because we can basically unlock access of anything for you. And that's the thing, because then we are able to move it forward together. And then the other option is basically remote telepresence and interaction, like controlling a machine on far away distance, like teleoperation, and that one is mostly based on ROS operating system, robotic operating system. And again, for that to operate it, you need certain adjustments and changes. And I would say that is second, like most suitable use case for using the current headset and bringing something new.
Mm-hmm. So if you're a scientist out there and you need VR and eye tracking, or you're working on telepresence with robots, you should probably convince someone to give you a budget to get this headset. Because speaking out of my experience where I worked in a lab, talking to big corporations, getting hardware from them, getting access to the APIs, it is very difficult because you're just not taking seriously. You have yourself a scientific background, and the people I talk to today in your office seem to be very open to science in general. I mean, you have, of course, your economical constraints, blah, blah, blah. But still, if you are a scientist out there and you're considering doing some amazing stuff, I would say that, you know, VR engineer seems to be a good option to at least ask and see whether you can, you know, move forward or not. So coming to the end of the episode, any last famous words or anything that is a secret you would like to share?
Not really. I hope that I shared enough interesting stuff.
you did share a lot, of course. So, as usual, at the end of the episode, that's something that usually is usual, but this time by me and not by Azad. We like to thank everyone for listening to this episode. You can find us on iTunes and on every other podcast platform. You can subscribe to our Twitter channel or follow us. We have a Facebook page where we post regularly the episodes. There is a Discord channel where I would like also to invite you. If you have any time, you know, you can chat when the episode is there with the listeners that are very active. Our community is growing and we have very dedicated people, a lot of scientists, but also industry experts there. And we have also a Patreon page where you can support this podcast. So in order for us and me to continue doing this podcast more frequently, more regularly, in order for me and us to continue doing this podcast and you know, for us to travel around the world and visit companies, get a better overview of what the current cutting edge technologies is, you know, you can spend a buck on our Patreon. It's less than a half cup of coffee, as other podcasts usually say. But of course, you can also support us by spreading the word, by sharing this episode. And that will not only help us, but also our guests, for example, the video engineers. Thank you very much. We will be very soon back with you. Goodbye.
And thank you, Haptex, for sponsoring another episode of the Research VR podcast. If you are a developer and you are interested in haptic feedback and you want to help develop one of the most interesting products in haptic feedback in VR, check out Haptex's careers page at haptex.com/careers. They have a number of open positions that they're trying to fill in. So many of you listeners, I know, have the right skills and talent for jobs like this. So check them out and thank you again for listening. Goodbye.